podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a returning guest joining us this week. He is an acclaimed and prolific chess author and historian. He writes the long-running Chess to Enjoy column for Chess Life magazine. He's got, I don't know how many books under his belt. I'm guessing under 50. We'll ask him in a minute. He's been busier than ever lately with an expanded and updated version of his acclaimed book, Bobby Fischer Rediscovered. And he has also just released the book, How to Swindle in Chess. And he's got even more on the way. So welcome back to the program, Grandmaster Andy Soltis.
Glad to be here, Ben. I enjoyed the last time we talked.
Likewise, yeah. And we're recording under this. Of course, every day feels like strange circumstances right now. We're recording just for Let the Record Show for on March 23rd, 2020. So between the ongoing chess candidates and the COVID-19 virus ravaging the world, unfortunately, who knows what will have transpired by the time this comes out. Listeners, I hope you all are doing okay and taking care of yourselves. But we are going to only touch on the candidates and try not to talk about anything that will be obsolete in 2 weeks' time. But I think we can handle that. But Andy, one thing that I found of interest was you were one of the first travel plan changes I came across, in that we were originally planning on doing this interview a little bit later, but you were going to be on one of these cruise ships.
My wife and I were going to be on the Grand Princess as of next week. That's the second ship that was stricken and ended up being held hostage in San Francisco Bay for a while until they offloaded the passengers. So we had to cancel that, and it's been a strange experience. But you know, we've had plans canceled in the past, and we're going to get back to traveling when this is all over.
Yeah, listeners, my previous interview with Grandmaster Soltis was episode 91 in September of 2018. And among many of Andy Soltis's works that we discussed, he also discussed the fact that he's retired and his affinity for travel. So yeah, hopefully it doesn't keep you sidelined for too long, but the important thing is that you and Marcy are healthy. I hope you're doing everything you can to remain so.
Oh, yes, definitely. I'm not going to go outdoors today. I didn't go outdoors yesterday, and I hope to stay indoors all week.
Yeah, as you were saying before we recorded, a lot of chess players feel well prepared for this. We're often introverts by nature, so bring it on.
Mm-hmm. You know, chess is one of the few things that you can do in your house. One of the things I fear for is that when this is all over the board, chess is going to take a bad hit, because people will just get out of the habit of playing over the board tournaments as we know them, and you know, chess to them will become purely games played online, and it'd be really a sad thing if that disappeared.
Yeah, it's a tricky, with the competitive aspect, it's a tricky issue, because if you could just somehow put a lid on the cheating issue, which obviously is no small task, the idea of being able to play competitive rated chess from home, I think, is quite appealing, especially for working adults. But on the other hand, as you're likely alluding to, sort of the social aspect of getting together in chess does get lost a little bit. So maybe there's some medium where you can still do, where you can do some competitive chess at home, but there's still a place for chess clubs, which have such a rich history and can provide a sense of community that it's just hard to mimic online.
Yeah, I know what you mean. When I was in college, I had like four priorities. One was to keep my grades up. Second was to work on the college newspaper. Third was to work part-time as a copy boy at the New York Post. Chess was the fourth priority, but one of the important things about that was once a week I would go to the Marshall Chess Club. That was my connection to chess. And in fact, on Friday nights, after, you know, working at the college newspaper, I'd go to the Marshall basically to catch a nap so I could sleep for several hours and then go to work at midnight at the Post. So it was more than just a place to play chess. It was a club in the traditional sense of a club.
Yeah, as a former New Yorker who lived in Brooklyn in one of the outer boroughs, I remember well the, you know, you need little places you can squat if you're going to make a trip in New York. It's you know, you it often doesn't make sense to go home and back if you've got something happening later in the day. So among the many benefits of the historic Marshall Chess Club, that is definitely one of them. And of course, you've got your share of great chess stories. You told the one of your blitz game against Bobby Fischer. But could you set the scene of who else, what other historical chess figures you came across in your younger days in New York?
Well, I played a whole slew of them. This is the golden age of American chess of the 50s. So this includes the Byrne brothers, although they were not living in New York at the time. Robert came back to New York only around 1968 to start the second act of his career. But I played Arthur Bisguier many times, Jimmy Sherwin, Lombardi, of course. All these guys were familiar faces. Mrs. Marshall, Carolyn Marshall, widow of Frank, was always complaining that she didn't see those guys very often because they had grown up at the Marshall, but then when they got better, they became traders. They went to the Manhattan Chess Club. And she thought that was absolutely outrageous. That was actually the case of Fischer as well. But, you know, Ray Weinstein, I remember seeing, he was a pretty strong player, and a fellow of Bobby's era. And of course, there were young players at the time. I remember playing in the Marshall Junior Championship, and I think 1964, and playing Bruce Pandolfini. For example, guys like that, we grew up playing in the same tournaments and socializing and that type of stuff.
And what about Grandmaster Ross Alimo? He's a name that I know he made his way to New York. Did you come across him?
Oh, yeah. The first time I in fact, saw Ross Alimo, and in fact, I tell it it was in the original book on Bobby Fischer Rediscovered, and you know, it's now still part of the introduction, but a lesser part, is I was walking down the street when I was, I guess, I don't know, let me think, 14 years old with my mother and my grandmother from Newton, Iowa, and my mother, who, you know, we had moved to New York, but my grandmother still lived in Iowa, and my mother was trying to shock her mother by showing her the bohemian streets of Greenwich Village. So we're walking down Sullivan Street, and there's this strange sign that says chess. So I had little interest in chess at the time. I really didn't get to chess until I was 14. And I convinced them to look inside, and this was the Ross Alimo chess studio where he held court. And he was there, and Bobby Fischer had just shown up. And I had a vague idea who Bobby Fischer was. I had heard about him only anecdotally. And here was Fischer talking to Ross Alimo, who they were old friends. And Fischer was telling him about this tournament he played in a place called Bled in Yugoslavia. And he was, like, commenting on their games. And what struck me at the time was that this was in a little part of his studio, which was sort of a storefront, could be a grocery store, a small grocery store, but except they were just decked out with tables of chess sets, and he had chess sets in the window that he was selling for, you know, some interesting prices. But most of the people in that small little studio were playing chess and playing with one another, and you had to pay the outrageous fee. I think it was like 15 cents an hour to play.
Right.
And they couldn't care less who these other people, this Fischer guy was, because hey, they were interested in their game. So that was my introduction to Rossellimo, and my introduced, well, I didn't get to meet him really until much later. I played him a couple of times. I think they were both draws. I think he was a little bit afraid of me, but he was quite a character.
Huh, yeah. And always well known as, emigrated to the U.S. for a better life and, obviously accomplished as a chess player, probably best known for the Rossellimo variation of the Sicilian these days, but also drove a taxi to make a living. I mean, he really sounds like he did whatever he needed to.
Yeah, he also recorded an album of folk songs. I think some of them were Russian that he sang. And he also went back and forth between America and France. I think his son went to the same high school that I went to, Stuyvesant High School, for a brief period. This is many years before I went. But I think he left after 1 year because his father had moved back to France, where he had many years of history before he came to the U.S. In fact, I think Nick played for France in a couple of the Olympic teams. I think he may have played some of the years that the United States didn't send a team, because during the 50s there just wasn't any money for chess.
Yeah, I'm glad that things have progressed nicely in that regard. I mean, obviously they could still get better, but yeah, I mean, the top players are able to support themselves. How strong was Rossellimo as a player?
At his peak, he was one of the best players in Europe, and I guess Western Europe, I'd have to qualify that. In the United States, he was past his prime, but he was still capable of playing, top-notch game with just about anyone. He got into some pretty strong U.S. championships during the 50s. They were like all-star events. they're like half a dozen players in those tournaments would have been in the world's top 50. Today in the U.S. Championship, four maybe of the players in the U.S. Championship would be in the top 50. Even now, when we have this all-star lineup of really great players. But Rossellimo was quite powerful.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So many characters. It's great to get your perspective on all these, both legends in New York and well-known players throughout the chess world. But you mentioned today's players, and of course, we're not going to do a sort of blow-by-blow of the candidates, because by the time listeners hear of this, it will have, I want to say completed. I mean, hopefully it will have finished with all the rounds played, but as we record this, Nepomniachtchi just took a 1.5-point lead and then announced that he's not feeling well. although said he took the test. So anyway, but there's no need to, I don't want to rehash that, because you guys already know, whoever's listening, how the story resumes. But I did want to pick your brain a little bit, Andy, since you have so much historical knowledge and have seen so many candidate cycles. Can you think of anything resembling today's players playing under these conditions with coronavirus testing and some players understandably complaining about the fact that the event's taking place, like Wang Hao and Alexander Grisha? Can you think of anything even remotely comparable over the years?
The only thing that I can think of that is like it, and it's a bit of a stretch, it's the Mannheim tournament of 1914, which wasn't a candidates tournament, but it was a very strong event with Aliekhin and Marshall, and I think Bogolyubov was in it. This was every 2 years there would be a German Chess Union Congress, and this was the big tournament of the year. If you wanted to get the real master title, you played in the German Chess Union Congress. And it was played just after, during the events, during the Guns of August, World War I was beginning. And every round was held under the expectation that very soon something's going to happen. We're going to be all arrested since we're foreigners, unless you were a German, or you'd be dispatched to some sort of camp, which some of the players ended up being taken to basically a POW camp, where they ended up spending the war playing chess with one another. And there was also a fear that, you know, the French army might arrive and invade Germany at that point, because nobody knew who had the edge. You know, the old story of World War One was that the Germans going to sweep through the Low Countries so that their right sleeve would be in the water, and they had to reach Paris so they could end the war like they had in 1870, or the French would invade through the south, and nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. And there were rumors going through this Mannheim tournament every day about the tournament's going to be canceled, and eventually it was canceled, and they paid off the players with sort of prorated prizes based on whatever money they could find, and Marshall somehow got out of Europe, although I think he said that he didn't get all of his luggage in time, and one of his bags finally arrived in New York several years later. Never under figure out how that happened.
Unbelievable. Yeah, the Fabiano, in one of the post-game interviews, was saying he didn't know if he was going to get home, how he was going to get home. Yeah, that's great historical perspective. And, of course, the Rubinstein-Lasker match was also didn't happen in 1914. Yeah, and it's we'll see what happens. It's kind of
One of the things that strikes me about the tournament that we're seeing now is it reflects the kind of chess has become something like tennis to me. It seems like there's two types of games. They're either aces. In other words, some guy has an opening innovation that just knocks the game out very quickly, or you have these long volleys. And a typical day in the candidates tournament, somebody sits down, rips off 30 moves, and literally, you know, takes only 1 minute off his clock. You know, I've been following the games on Chess Bomb, and you can see it on many other sites, but you can also pay attention to the clock times. And Nepomniachtchi, he won a game basically just by sitting down and with his memory. He didn't have to start thinking until move 35. His clock, it lost about 10 minutes at that point. And his opponent resigned out 5 minutes later, 5 moves later. That's an ace. And if you don't ace your opponent, then you get into these long volleys where you play on and on and on with a minimal advantage, and it becomes Carlsen chess, you know, where you're you're trying to squeeze the most out of a 70-move game. And as Magnus does, he so often wins.
Yeah, more so than anyone. That calls to mind a couple things. Number one, again, the candidates is so much in my mind right now. Grishuk, just today after his game with Caruana, said it's hard to have high ambitions when you play half the game against a computer. But the other interesting thing is that it's true that you occasionally get these knockouts, but you also get these sort of false flags. Like the Ding Caruana game was particularly fascinating to me because
that was man beats computer.
Yeah, I mean, he sprung this novelty, but then somehow he was just worse.
Yeah, I thought I was witnessing the modern version of Capablanca versus Marshall, when Marshall introduced the Marshall Gambit and the Roy Lopez. And, Capablanca had a choice. He could have declined accepting the Marshall Gambit, but he's, you know, it's like when Fischer was surprised by one of Petrosian's moves in during their candidates match. And he could have declined to take the sacrifice. But as he explained later, he said, "I wanted to see what he had."
Yeah.
And Capablanca wanted to see what Marshall had. And Ding Lirent did this amazing job of defending. And eventually, Caruana ran out of steam. Yeah. You know, this is the type of thing that Fischer really didn't play that type of chess. He won a couple of games by aces. But he was more in the Carlsen style. There was a game that Fischer played against Bent Larsen at Zurich in 1959, and he got to a position end game. Fischer has two bishops and a king, and he has three kingside pawns, and Larsen has two knights and a king and three kingside pawns. the pawns aren't damaged, and that's all they left on the board. And Mikhail Tal wrote in the tournament book, what's going on here? Is this a draw? Does this American think that we in Europe are so naive that we can lose a position like this? And later on, in a couple years later, Tal criticized Fischer by saying that he played on in a position until there was nothing left on the board but just two kings. Well, guess what happened? At Vikings A a couple months ago, in the last round, Carlsen was playing Wesley So of the United States. The final position, there's just two kings. They played on and on until there was nothing left on the board. And this is not unusual for Carlsen, because he had a game like that against Nigel Short several years ago. And after it, he said, it's really pleasant to end with nothing but two kings left on the board. So it's amazing how they have so much energy for chess, and they play until the bitter end. That's the most unusual thing, I think, about chess today.
Yeah, and I think it's probably mildly intimidating. I mean, it can't be a great feeling when you have one of these end games, even if it's an equal end game against Carlsen, but you know he's going to have you sitting there grinding for 3.5 hours trying to get blood from a stone. Like, that's intimidating, and I think it could be harder to play your best under those circumstances, although, of course, players of that level are quite practiced at it.
Yeah, of course. There was a game in the Fischer versus Taimanov match, Fischer, it was before one of the games that I used in the Bobby Fischer versus Rediscovered, the great bishop versus knight endgame that Fischer won. But Fischer had pressed Taimanov quite a bit, and then they had to adjourn. And before they adjourned, Taimanov could have given up a piece and gotten to a rook and bishop versus rook endgame. He would have the rook, Fischer would have the rook and the bishop. And while he was adjourned, his seconds asked him, what are you doing? Don't you know that's a draw? And Taimanov said, yes, I know it's a draw, but I knew that Fischer would press me to the very end, and I just didn't want to go through that experience.
Wow.
So he didn't give up his piece for the pawn, and he ended up losing that endgame. And that's another funny thing that I should mention. Just recently, the games that Taimanov played, the practice games he played before he faced Fischer, they've been like a Soviet state secret for many, many years, because I alluded to them in my January Chess Life column when I talked about training up. Taimanov played a practice match of like 8 or 10 games against two grandmasters, very strong players. One was Yuri Balashov, and the other is Yevgeny Vasyukov. And Vasyukov and Balashov were in a separate room. They could move the pieces on their board to analyze. They could use opening books. They could use endgame books. And when they made their move on the clock, they had an extra hour more than Taimanov. So he's playing super grandmasters, basically, guys who should be like 400 points better than him. And these games have never been revealed until just recently by Balashov. You can find them on one of the Russian websites. And the striking thing about them is that Taimanov was not in good shape at that time. I mean, Fischer was, it's magnificent that Fischer won 6-0, but he didn't play very well in these practice games. So that was a harbinger of what was to come.
Huh, that's interesting. So did you come across that in your research for Bobby Fischer Rediscovered, or in the Chess Life column you mentioned, or how did you come?
I just found out about that the other day. I knew about the training games, and in fact, there's a dispute about how many games what the results were. Taimanov said basically all the games were drawn, and Vasyukov said no, we crushed him, and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And they just turned up on a Russian site in the last month. Sometimes you can't figure out exactly what the truth is. It takes a while for it to be revealed. Another thing about Fischer that strikes me, there was a book, you may never have even seen it. It was called Bobby Fischer, the Greatest? It was written by Max Ertha in the 70s. and he was trying to make the case that Fischer was the probably the greatest player who ever lived. And he compared Fischer with Capablanca, in particularly in the endgame, and with Eliekin, particularly in the middle game, and so on. And he gave a Capablanca game, and he said, look, notice how the simplicity, the purity of Capablanca's plan. And here's a Fischer game. Here's another Fischer endgame, which is more complex. And, in fact, he used this Taimanov game that I did use in the book, the bishop versus knight endgame, with all the like six pawns apiece. And he said, Fischer is much more complex. Fischer has these maneuvers that it's really hard to detect what's going on. And I think Ervig missed the point about that, because when Fischer died, there was a memorial service at the Marshall Chess Club. And several people who knew Fischer spoke, including Dick Cavett, the talk show host. Frank Brady was the host. And Asa Hoffman, who's an old friend of mine, spoke. But there was a guy named Renato Naranja, a Filipino player, who had played in the Interzonal in 1970 with Fischer. Fischer won the Interzonal easily. But there was one game that Naranja had drawn with Taimanov. And in fact, in the final position, which is before adjournment time, Naranja has the two bishops and against Taimanov's bishop and a knight. He has a better pawn structure. And Fischer said, like, what wrong there? Didn't you know you were better? And Naranja said, no, well, of course I knew I was better, but, you know, I didn't see how I was going to win. And Fischer thought this was amazing. Well, you don't have to know how. Just move the pieces around. You have the two bishops. And that was his philosophy, which is, I guess, the Carlsen philosophy to some extent. Something's going to turn up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah, and it definitely highlights the similarities. I mean, Carlsen, of course, learns from all of the legends, but took a little bit from everyone. And, yeah, obviously in the conversation now for the greatest. These are some great Fischer stories already. What else did you discover in updating Bobby Fischer Rediscovered? Like was there a discovery that was the impetus for the desire to update this, or was it more just that it had been a while and stuff had filtered out?
Actually, I was working on the book on how to swindle in chess, and it's well into it, and then I got an email from the publisher saying this was, I guess, a year ago in January, saying that they were interested in doing the Fischer book. In fact, I started work on the revision of the Fischer book exactly 1 year ago today. But what struck me when I started working on it, the Bobby Fischer Rediscovered came out in 2001. It was the first book I used a computer to analyze. And I thought I found some interesting stuff with the help of the computer. And a few years later, Garry Kasparov wrote his great predecessor's book on Fischer, and he credited some of my analysis, which surprised me. And he found some improvements because, well,
didn't surprise you.
It didn't surprise me. But then when I looked at these games again, both the games that he analyzed and the games that I did originally with a current computer, and there are a bunch of computers online that you can use for free, I'm amazed at how much I got wrong in 2001. And there's improvements you can find on Kasparov. That was the point I made in that February Chess Life column about the half-life of truth, that here's that Fischer game against Tal, which was supposed to be, it was a win for Fischer, you know, after they, back when it was played in 1959, and then the position turns out to be a draw, according to Kasparov, and now, well, or it might be a draw, and now it's definitely a draw. So you find a lot more with the help of computers nowadays, and that was I kept, like, rewriting page after page of that Bobby Fischer book. And the other thing that I added to the book, and it's in the epilogue and some other parts, is I wanted to use games that have been forgotten, mainly because, well, in those days, Fischer's non-tournament games were not considered serious. You know, he included this one game against a guy named Seeley, and it was from a simultaneous exhibition that he gave in California. And it was highly unusual that he was giving an exhibition game, a simul game, even though it was a clock simul. And that's a very fine game that it appears in my my 60 Memorable Games by Fischer. What struck me is that I looked at the other games that Fischer played in that simul, and they're amazing. And for many years, you couldn't find these because they just didn't appear. You know, you look into a database of Fischer games, and 1964 was a blank because 1964, he wasn't playing in the interzonal. He was just doing this cross-country simul tour. And so those games just didn't exist. Well, I found a game against a guy named Roy Hoppe. It's a spectacular game. It was played during the same exhibition in which Fischer was playing this game against Selle that he used in his book. And I analyzed that, and that's a really wonderful game that I included in this. And in fact, neither of those games were the one that he was probably concentrating on the most, because there was another game that he played in that exhibition against John Blackstone, which I think you can probably find now online, in which Blackstone was getting in this furious sacrificial attack against Fischer, and was going back and forth, and who knows how that was going to turn out. That, I think, was the game that Fischer was really worried about. So his ability to concentrate on all of those things is just amazing. Another thing I should mention is that you also got an insight from his simul games, what openings that Fischer was exploring. And I remember there was a book called Chess Openings, Ancient and Modern. And modern meant 1893. It was written by two guys named Freeborough and Rankin. And I remember it came out, was republished after the Fischer-Spassky match in 1972 with an introduction by Frank Brady. And Frank wrote in the introduction that he saw Fischer's own copy of this book with Fischer's own notes penciled in. Why would Fischer care what was played, you know, in 1862? Well, he did, because according to Brady, Fischer had all sorts of interesting new ideas about the Danish gambit and the Scotch game and the Evans gambit. Now, of course, it's funny that the Scotch and the Evans were later revived by Kasparov. But I wonder what Fischer had to say about him. And my God, is there anything new to say about the Danish gambit? I can't imagine. But, you know, who knows? So Fischer took a lot of secrets with him.
Yeah, although getting back to your column, The Half-Life of Truth, that you mentioned in Chess Life magazine, that was one of my favorites out of your recent columns. The idea being that people like to debate basically about, like, you know, in some famous position, like you mentioned, the Fischer-Spassky game one end game, could Fischer have held it? Could Fischer not have held it? And it goes back and forth over the years based on the available information. And now we're getting closer and closer to a final verdict. But then again, it's like almost 50 years later, at some point, like, you know, are we really going to keep reshaping the narrative, as you say, every time a new move emerges? And in a similar vein, what you say about the opening novelties, it makes me a little bit sad, because, like, Fischer may have uncovered something really cool in the Danish that was way ahead of its time, but now we can just fire up the 3500 engine, and it's like, is whatever he discovered really going to be able to compete with that?
Yeah, it's something that's going to be amazing as computers get stronger and stronger. Who knows? The other thing that I was interested in, when I was doing the Fischer book, I was also preparing another book on Soviets, and I was doing this book on Swindles. And I, the funny thing is that I had to put the Swindles book aside for months. And I alluded to it in again in Chess Life when I wrote early in 2019. I said that there should be a new symbol for annotators. Some of the old symbols that we use, like a plus over minus, just don't work for endgames anymore, because in many of the endgames we know, you know, this is a not just a plus, it's a win or a draw.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no other possibility. But we need a symbol that would cover the type of move that is the most practical to play. It's a move that the computers will definitely say is objectively not the best, but it is the best chance for you. You know, if you're down a rook and you have an attack and you're technically lost, the computer's going to tell you to trade queens because that'll minimize your disadvantage. It'll prolong the game. Well, that's insane. And so in this Chess Life column, I propose using a new symbol to designate this this most practical move. And it's sort of the Swindler move. And that's how I developed the idea for the book, How to Swindle in Chess. And then the funny thing is then the book should have probably come out last year, but for whatever reason, it just came out recently. And then I found out almost the day I got my own copy of it that New in Chess had published their own version, which I'm sure is a very fine book. I haven't seen it. But and you can probably get some of these books online, although you may have noticed that Amazon is now delaying deliveries of like a month for chess books and other things. You can get other books. You can get the same books, you know, from the USCF and other sources, but you may have to hunt to find some of my books.
Yeah, the Andy's book, Grandmaster Soltis's book, being called How to Swindle in Chess. And yeah, I also noticed that I got emails almost probably, I mean, I knew about your book from corresponding with you, but at a very similar time from Grandmaster David Smeridan, who of course has been on the show, and I'm also a big fan of his writing, called The Complete Chess Swindler. So Andy, I've got some follow-up questions for you about How to Swindle in Chess, but first we're going to take a quick break.
Grandmaster Andy Soltis is one of my favorite people to hear chess history and stories from, and if you want more of that sort of thing, check out Garry Kasparov's acclaimed My Great Predecessors series on chessable.com. Kasparov places the chess contributions of all of the greats in historical context, and Chessable's Move Trainer technology provides trainable examples from Kasparov's game analysis. Volumes 1 to 4 of My Great Predecessors are already available on Chessable, and Volume 5 featuring Karpov and Korchnoi is coming soon to Chessable.com. Back to the interview.
So Andy, as you say, the book is still making its way into the world, and I haven't gotten a chance to check it out yet, How to Swindle in Chess. But we've got a lot of listeners with, as we alluded to earlier, with stuck in their homes ready to work on some chess. So this, I imagine, How to Swindle in Chess skews more towards the practical side of chess competition. But what advice, if you were to kind of bullet point a few tips for how to play when you're in trouble, what did you discover in writing this book?
Well, I think one of the first points is you want to get an idea whether your position is truly desperate, whether it's, you know, swindle time, or you can hold a position just by minimizing his chances of winning. Then you have to figure out, if you're really lost, identify the key tactical resources. There are only a couple of them, probably in each position. You know, there's a diagonal that can be exploited. There's a file that you can attack, and you know, there are, chess is basically a game of good fortune, and there are ways that you can make yourself lucky. On one of the key points I've found is that if you can give your opponent choices, you have an excellent chance of getting him to make a mistake. It sounds crazy because, you know, if you're losing, you want to force matters. You want to limit his choices. You want him to make checks and threats and captures and so on, so that he doesn't have opportunities to think about what to do against you. But in fact, if you give him choices, you increase the likelihood of an error. He'll have more opportunities to go wrong. And I also found out that there are very different attitudes of the player who is going to be swindled, the swindlee, as I would call it.
Nice.
There are, you know, players who get swindled because they think only two results are possible. They think they're either going to win or they're going to draw, so they don't consider the possibility that you have a tactical resource. They don't see that, you know, that you're setting a trap. Or they think that they're going to, another mindset of the swindlee is he thinks he's going to win just by playing routine moves. I remember a game in New York in a speed tournament, where Vishy Anand had a winning position against Kasparov. And he just thought that, well, I'm going to advance. I have a passed connected h-pawn, and I just push that pawn. I'm going to win. And he disregarded what was happening on the other side of the board, and he's playing Kasparov. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, you don't let somebody like that get out of the box. Another way, well, there's some famous examples of what some players call swimming. When a player goes swimming, he doesn't have any ideas anymore. He thinks, you know, I'll just get to the past the time control. I don't have to do anything before that. It's more like treading water, actually. There was a famous game in a candidates' playoff in 1962 between Paul Karras and Yefim Geller. And whoever won that match would then be seeded into the candidates' matches the next time around. And that was really important because, as it turns out, there was a good possibility that whoever won that match would be playing a world championship match immediately, because if Botvinnik had decided not to defend his title in 1963, the winner of this playoff match between Karras and Geller would be playing for the world championship. Anyway, to get back to the game, Karras is just killing Geller. He wins the exchange. He's killing him all over the board, and then he just stops playing moves. He just like sort of waits and tries to find a way to reach. In those days, they had adjournments. He wants to get to the point where he can adjourn, and then, you know, the game will be over. Well, slowly but surely, Geller keeps coming up with these little shots. Karras misses them one after another, and he ends up losing the game. That could have been, you know, that would have been the tragedy of the final tragedy of Karras's life if he had ended up losing that match. As it turns out, he did win it, and Botvinnik did not give up the title prematurely, so it didn't have any effect on chess history, but it very nearly might have.
Yeah. So many great stories, and in thinking about this book, Andy, I was also curious. How would you go about researching it? Because I'm sure you have a huge mental file of games in your brain at this point, just from a life of reading about and studying chess. But in terms of looking for additional instructive examples, how would you approach finding swindles and then extracting lessons from them?
Yeah, that was a very hard thing, because it's not like you can't go on chessgames.com and use the search key.
Yeah, exactly.
I went through a huge library of books that I have, I found some wonderful examples. I mean, Capablanca swindling Ruben Fine at AVRO, for example. And in the more recent examples, Magnus Carlsen, you know, the young Magnus Carlsen was just an incredible swindler. You probably know the game where he swindled, Lokvan Vele, I think it was. He had a lost position. He had 9 seconds left and the position on the board was like, you know, plus six in favor of Von Vele. And not only did he, Carlsen, make the time control, but he won the game. And you know, Viktor Korchnoi was watching this, and he said that that just, without parapsychology, it's impossible to explain that.
What happened? Korchnoi knew his parapsychology.
Yes, he believed in that. But let's see, I found games like that. I found that Judith Polgar is an amazing swindler, and has been for many years. Alexander Grishuk always complained that, you know, whenever I play her, she swindles me. He would get, you know, wonderful positions, you know, again, plus two advantages that the computers say, you know, it's a matter of technique. And there it goes. And then, of course, I went back to Lasker because Lasker is like the before Marshall was a swindler, there was Lasker. He just had an amazing defensive ability. And let's see, what other things I discovered is that it's more than just a one move. Very rarely are there swindles that are just a matter of one move taking advantage of an oversight. It's usually a process. And often the swindlee makes one mistake that throws away a good part of his or her advantage. And he doesn't realize what's going on, and he becomes vulnerable. I think blundering is usually a two-stage process. And when you get into that blunder zone, you become more and more vulnerable. You know, as so often happens, a player will refuse a draw. I mean, Carlsen has been amazing when he had opportunities to draw positions that he had previously was lost. And he declines the opportunity. He plays on because he knows he smells defeat. He smells fear in his opponents. And that's just amazing. Fischer was like that also in some of his finest games. He rejected opportunities to simplify when he could have gotten a draw.
Great stuff. So yeah, I mean, it sounds well worth exploring, as well as the Fischer book, which has 100 games. And of course, you know, Fischer's my most memorable games, of course, only goes up to 1967 or something like that. So this has many more games from the great Fischer to learn from. So listeners can check them out as they would under normal circumstances already be available. And I think you can, at least with Bobby Fischer Rediscovered, I was able to get the Kindle ebook. So no friction to getting that book delivered.
No, I think you can get that. In fact, you know, Bobby actually saw the first edition of this Bobby Fischer Rediscovered. Somebody who was a friend of his from Iceland brought it to him in Iceland and gave him a copy, and they looked over the book. And he wrote about it in a recent book that was published, this Icelander, and Bobby apparently liked it.
Okay,
Yeah, I never have much contact with Fischer in later years, so I really don't know. But that sort of made my day when I read that.
Yeah, not so easy to get his stamp of approval. that's good to hear. And of course, I'm sure he remembered you from the New York days. So that's pretty cool. So Andy, last thing before we wrap this up, I was just curious, again, since we have so many people listening who are stuck at home and studying chess, what advice would you give? Let's say someone suddenly has 2 hours a day they could spend on chess, which was maybe unimaginable previously. How could they spend that time to get better?
Well, I would play a lot of chess. One of the amazing things about Magnus Carlsen is that he would go to a tournament like Vikingsey when he was young, and as soon as the day was done, he would go off and play on the ICC. And he's the first player, I think, who of the modern era, who grew up basically without a strong second when he was very young. He didn't have a teacher. He was self-educated. He wasn't learning by playing against a computer. He was playing just games, constantly against other players. If there's a human version of Alpha Zero learning the aspects of chess just by playing, that's Carlsen. And Carlsen is this amazing character because his versatility is his strength. It's not just, you know, that, okay, he can attack and he can defend. That is his ability, is that he can play any opening. He can play any type of endgame. There are no positions that you can say, okay, like with Petrosian. If Petrosian didn't get a Petrosian position, he was just not going to play well that day, and he would offer a draw. Tal, similar to that. If he didn't get the kind of tactical game, he was sort of not nearly as strong. Carlsen, I don't see any diminution in his ability in any type of position. He plays at full strength. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he just got this an enormous amount of experience. And he also learned how to lose. And that's an important thing. He learned how to take defeat. The old Soviet view was that two draws is better than a win and a loss, because if you lose a game, it destroys yourself. You're just not going to play well the next day. And Carlsen has this remarkable ability to come back after he loses a game, because he's lost many games before. Of course, it's hard to say that now when the guy's up, 115 games without a defeat?
Right, yeah.
Straight games. But learning how to get over defeat is actually part of the game. It's probably the most important psychological lesson, psychological skill that you can have. And chess is a series of skill sets that you have to internalize.
Excellent. Well, I don't think you'll have to tell our listeners twice to play a lot of chess. That's a relatively easy to take advice. Where do you come down on the debate about how helpful it is to play blitz chess as opposed to slower time controls when you're playing a lot of chess, as you say, to improve?
Yeah, I think that blitz chess is actually quite good. I agree with Bronstein, who said that you can play very good intuitive chess, and giving yourself an extra time to think about the moves, you might develop a somewhat better move. It's really that you put off you display your intuition in speed chess, and if you can learn to make quick moves, good quick moves, intuitively, that's the strongest thing you can work on. The other thing is, if you can also work on chess by playing over your own games. And again, another Bobby Fischer story. Ruth Herring described how when she was living in San Francisco with her husband, Peter Biasas, and Fischer was their house guest back in 1981. In fact, I visited their home with Marcy around that time. Fischer somehow did stick around to see us. It was during that sojourn when Fischer was staying with them that he saw her and asked, why do you keep all these score sheets, your old games? And she said, I don't know. I don't really know why I keep them. And he said, well, you should study them. You should go over them. They're really important. And he had an interest in other people's games. And it reminded me of something that Elliot Hurst told me. Elliot Hurst was a great player of the 1950s, who then became a psychologist and academic. But he was also a champion of the Marshall Chess Club. And several years ago, there was an evening at the Marshall that was in which past champions of the Marshall were honored. And I had known Elliot over the years. We see each other once every 10 years or so. But this is like the last time I saw him. And he said that he met Fischer sometime, I think, in the 90s. And they had dinner together. And then Fischer went into one of his political rants. And then Bobby said, well, let's take a look at a game. And Hurst said, but Bobby, you're much better than I am. You always were. I'm not playing chess these days. Why should we look at a game together? And Fischer's attitude was, of course we should look at it. You can learn from anyone. And you can certainly learn from playing over your own games. You can figure out, you know, what you went wrong. The old theory was that you should only look at your losses. But that's just depressing.
Right.
I mean,
it is, yeah.
You can actually learn more, I think, by looking at your victories. And nowadays you could do it with a computer and realize that you could have played better. That, you know, you got one of the positions that you play well, and there are still things that you can learn. Maybe you should prepare the attack a little better. Maybe you should take a little more time. Don't push that pawn in the end game that fast. Sometimes it gets ahead of you, and you know you can't catch up to it. Chess is such an elusive game. You can't master it in a lifetime. It'll take at least two.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Excellent stories and historical perspective as always, Andy. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's great. I know these are tough times, but let me tell you one final story.
Of course.
I was after I had finished the Fischer book, this was, I think, in October of 2001. And I was sitting at my desk at the New York Post, the editor called all of the reporters into the city room, which is very unusual. And we, you know, filed in. And then we saw some recognizable figures. They were the top medical officials of New York City, the top health department people. And they explained that someone had sent an envelope, a letter to the editor filled with anthrax to the Post a month before, and had been left unopened on somebody's desk. This is deadly stuff. And a couple weeks later, just because they're, you know, catching up on stuff that hadn't been done in the past month, this was right after September 11th, someone moved that envelope and some of the spores got out, and the people were infected with this skin form of anthrax, which is bad. The cutaneous form is bad, but it's not awful. And so the medical officials, the city health people, were saying, okay, just stay calm. This is, if you need antibiotics, we have them, but you're totally safe. It's not going to, it didn't become airborne. And since we're reporters, somebody said, well, how do you know it didn't become airborne? And the woman, official, I think she sort of smiled when she said, if it had become airborne, you'd all be dead by now. So on that note, I know that whatever there's some sort of protection out there that we're all going to get through this, and I want to be there with you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for being there with us. I know a lot of people, chess can be a great escape in these difficult times. And hopefully these stories provide some inspiration and some entertainment. And thanks again, Andy. I hope we can chat again sometime in the future. I know you're always busy, always on to the next book.
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Well, we are grateful for that. So thanks again, Andy. And wishing the best, you and your wife. Take care of yourselves and be safe.
Same to you.
Special thanks to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to you all for continuing to listen to and spread the word about Perpetual Chess. You can spread the word on Twitter. Follow me. I'm at BennyFischel1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the dialogue about each interview after it is released. I also want to thank the people who've written a few new reviews on Apple Podcasts. That's good to see. Reviews on other podcast platforms and YouTube are also appreciated. But of course, most of all, I would like to thank the people who provide financial support to the show, especially these days as a lot of our lives are in upheaval. We're stuck at home. There's work changes and all that stuff. So it means the world to me that you guys have stuck with me and even in some cases added new support in these crazy times. So thanks. I really appreciate it. For anyone who's able to support, it is the Perpetual Chess Patreon page, where you can donate through PayPal if you go to perpetualchesspod.com. chessmasters.com. So with that out of the way, first of all, of course, I would like to thank the sponsor of the show, Chessable. And I also would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities for their support. They include Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprentice Twitch Channel, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromarty, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lorraine Dore, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Moonmaster 9000, Peter Sodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, and I also would like to give thanks to the following people and entities: Aaron Waffler, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, FM Andre Tarakov, Andrew Perry, Aniti Deer, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Courtney Fry, David Bleskacek, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Douglas Matthew, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, or possibly not I am Elect, Donnie Ariel Esquire, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart-Lavois, Francis Tortoris, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovac, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Murr, Jason Anfong, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Stranad, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of the U.S. Chess Federation, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Alert, Miguel Araspati, Mike Clem, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solin, Neil Bruce, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Dougherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Thomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Wayne Beam, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Soyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I will catch you all soon.
Podcast Network.